All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of The Big Questions with Big John, right here on Grumblings Media. This is a show where I love talking to people from all walks of life. As long as they have an interesting story to tell, I'm here for it. And tonight's guest, this episode's guest, actually really, really fits the bill. So let me just quickly look down and make sure I get her bio correctly. This episode, we're joined by a dynamic libertarian leader who founded a movement that's transforming New Hampshire's political scene by championing individual liberty and minimal government. She's originally from South Africa, having emigrated to the U.S. in the 1990s, leveraging a background in law and technology from her previous roles at Apple and Logitech to fuel her impactful activism. She's an accomplished author, artist, and attorney. She secured a landmark First Amendment victory for filming police. The fact that people can walk around now and film the cops doing nasty things. We can thank our guest for that right. Organized the renowned Porcupine Freedom Festival, but nobody uses that term. They all say Pork Fest, if that's what you've heard in the past. She's also penned the collection of essays, The Ecstatic Pessimist, which is a powerful collection of her anecdotes and speeches. Everyone, please welcome Carla Hedeke. As I took a quick lesson in Afrikaans before this, but here in America, us dumb Americans have dumbed down her name to Carla Garrick. So, Carla, welcome to the show. Glad you could join us tonight.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting. We were talking a little bit before the show, and you did grow up in South Africa. And so I want to talk a little bit about that, because I think for many Americans, especially the not people of our generation, Carla, but the younger generation, may not have been fully aware of what was happening in South Africa. They may have read it in a history book or something. And I kind of joked into it by saying, you know, the pronunciation of your surname being Hedeke instead of Garrick, and how dumb Americans kind of simplified it when you came to the country, right? But that's a story that's familiar to a lot of immigrants. And with everything that's happening now, if you don't mind, tell me a little bit about your childhood in South Africa, growing up under, I'm assuming, under apartheid while it was still in place. So talk to me about, first of all, your family life. How was a young Carla getting along in South Africa?
Well, that is a rich and deep and wide question. So first I should start with my dad was a diplomat who worked for the apartheid regime. So that's kind of my cross to bear. So right. Although I grew up in South Africa, I actually grew up very internationally as well. So my youth started, was born in 72, and from 73 to 78, actually, we lived in New York City. My dad worked for the UN. My mom was in art school. New York at that time was kind of that dodgy time with the subways, with the graffiti. And then went back to South Africa in 78. I'm not going to go into every place we lived, but suffice to say, I was in 6 primary schools by the time I was 10. And then when I was 10, my parents actually sent me to an all-girls boarding school in Pretoria, which is the capital of South Africa, for half the year, because nothing's ever easy under statism. And then it moves to Cape Town for 6 months of the year as well.
Oh, interesting.
So they used to snowbird without the snow in South Africa way back in the day. They would kind of travel to whatever region was more favorable during which climate time. So I had a pretty unusual upbringing, but I think it also really helped to inform me as a human and as a person, right?
Right.
I half jokingly always say if I had a magic wand and I could have one diktat, you know, mine would actually be that everyone should travel and travel a lot, because I think there's much more that unites humanity than what divides us. And I love technology. My background's technology, but honestly, I think tech is putting us down a really divided, polarized road at the moment. And so if people traveled more, they'd be reminded, hey, we're just all human. We're here. We're going to be here for a short time. How can we live exemplary and amazing lives?
You know, that's a great point, because as you were talking and you mentioned New York City in the 70s and you're going back and forth, you know, I'm actually from the Bronx. So, you know, and so I grew up in the heart of what you just described as sort of that grittiness, that grime, like every New York movie you ever saw in the 70s, like what's the one with Charles Bronson, Death Wish or something like that. So, yeah, I understand what you mean. Now, it's interesting to me that living the life of a diplomat's child, so you're in New York, I'm assuming somewhere near the UN, obviously, if you're a diplomat's child, then going back to South Africa, moving around a lot. Also, if I can use the broad term, a child of privilege in that sense.
Sure.
So especially when you saw the, not necessarily the grime of New York, because again, if you were living in Manhattan around the UN, you may not have been fully exposed to that. But if you were, you know, a teenager that got out, I'm sure you hopped on the subway to go to the seedier parts of town on occasion. Talk to me a little bit how that compared to what was going on in South Africa, with what was going on with Botha's regime, with the apartheid, because were you insulated, perhaps, and I'm just asking here, from what might have been considered the reality of what was happening with apartheid? Or were you aware of it as a young child? How did that affect you?
So, you know, again, I use the words deep because, you know, this is such a fascinating life that I led. And also, honestly, you know, I'm in my mid-50s now and I'm still kind of unpacking all of this. I think right now, because of the stories we're hearing from South Africa and all of that. Now, look, apartheid was a socialist, nationalist program, right? So, you know, we have to call things by their proper names. It was a police state. It was very controlled. The, you know, 7% of the population, the white population, controlled 93% of the rest of the population, mostly by keeping them in what were referred to as homelands. These were special areas, much like I would say like an Indian tribal land to some extent, right? And they were very tribal in the sense that there are many different tribes in South Africa. So South Africa's history and understanding is very difficult to unpack. Some of the things, you know, your listeners might need to know is there are 11 official languages. That means there are at least 11 tribes, right? So we've all heard sort of about the white, black stuff that was under the umbrella of apartheid. Things you haven't heard about is that the black tribes, many of them don't really get on and don't like each other, primarily the Zulus and the Xhosas. And, you know, those are two very large factions. They used to go to war. They have their own beefs and histories, right? Amongst the white people, you had the Afrikaners, who are the Boers. The word Boer literally means farmer. That would be like my forefathers. You know, so my great-grandmother had a farm outside Pretoria.
Right.
But then, of course, there's also under the white people, you have the British, and the British kind of came after the Boers came. So the Dutch, who were the Boers, the farmers, kind of showed up in the 1600s, in the mid to late 1600s. They showed up because they were like, hey, we discovered this thing called spices from India. And you know what makes our food better? Spices from India. You know, there's a reason English food is extremely bland. And there's
well, I was going to share a joke with you because in saying that, you just reminded me. I said I knew a very good friend of mine back in the day was Cuban, and he had married an English lady. And he said, oh, no, my wife's not typically English. She uses all the spices on the food, salt and pepper.
Exactly. I right? mean, honestly... Yeah. I had mentioned I traveled a lot. There's a saga after the dot-com bubble bursts in, you know, 2000, where my husband and I end up backpacking through Southeast Asia and India. And one of the standing jokes in India would always be, you know, how spicy would you want your food? Or often in foreign countries, right? And
right.
There was a chef once in Thailand, and I was like, no, I want it Thai spicy. And he was like, are you sure?
I made that mistake once.
Yes. I regretted my answer. I mean, yes. it was too spicy for me. But then we always say in England that the standing joke of the alternative is, how bland would you like your food? On a, you know, a scale of one to four. So the farmers came, And they were primarily coming because of that trade route between India and Europe, primarily England at the time. Holland at the time. And then the Brits, of course, as they are wont to do, were like, oh, what do you guys have down there? Do you have gold? Do I see? Mm. Well, then, right? So then the British showed up. And, and there were two wars that were fought, the Anglo-Boer War or the Boer-Anglo War, kind of depending on who you were asking. And what was really interesting there, actually, although my home language is Afrikaans and I grew up in an Afrikaner home, I did go to an English primary school because I was overseas a lot, and then went to an English high school in South Africa and then to an Afrikaans law school. Don't recommend. That's kind of like a scramble for your brain. Okay. But my husband went to an Afrikaans, you know, primary school, high school, university. We met at university. And our interpretations or learned history of the, Anglo-Boer Wars, because I'd learned the British history and he had learned the Boer history, was one of those informing experiences in my life, because when we started dating, you know, we're both smart and well-read, and we would kind of argue about stuff, and I'd be like, no, no, and he'd be like, no, no. And of course, the Boer story is, hey, these Rooinekke, which translates to rednecks, because they would burn their necks red when they were lying in the fields, because they were used to the African sun, came and, you know, they wanted to build from Cape to Cairo. It was this huge colonialization. Which we're actually seeing now with China, although no one wants to talk about that. China is colonizing Africa through capitalism, and everyone's just going, looking away, right?
Right.
And so there were the two wars. Then we were under British rule for, what happened, the wars, and then they lost. Then a lot of the people moved out of the Cape area into other regions, which weren't necessarily populated by tribes. So there's sort of that story of, you know, everyone stole everyone's land, but when you unpack it, not all of that is entirely accurate. The original people of South Africa are the Khoisan. They are different to the Bantu people, which are the black tribes. So honestly, I mean, it's a lot. South Africa is a lot to unpack. But, you know, apartheid was socialist. It was a hard place to grow up. So some examples, you know, there was a lot of censorship. So, like, literally words blacked out of newspapers. Mm. There was military conscription for all young white males. I had a lot of friends, fortunately, my husband actually, and many people who had, as you used the word, the privilege to, either kept studying to try and avoid it, or they would go to England, to sort of get away from it. But many of my friends who actually did go, who were conscripted, you know, have PTSD now. They were forced into border wars that were illegal. The apartheid regime had nuclear weapons, which Israel gave us and America gave to Israel. You know, so there was this threat of sort of race war at some stage. So, you know, I actually ended up doing a lot of anti-apartheid work when I was in law school, because that was like, you know, I started in 89 and I graduated in 93, and Nelson Mandela first free elections, that was in 94. So, when I was in high school, we were still a white high school. And then when I was in standard 7, I believe, we go up to grade 10. We actually opened the school up to Chinese and Japanese students. And then to Indians, because there's also the Indian population, which kind of came with that trade route. Right. And there's a fairly large Indian population. And then on top of it all, there's also a large population called the coloreds. That's not derogatory. It's how they self-identify. And that's a mixed race. And they identify culturally with the Afrikaners and speak Afrikaans. And there are about 1 million of that group. So really what it is it's kind of a melting pot in a similar way to, I think, many ways that America was. I know everyone's down on immigrants right now, but you know that'll come back around again because I've seen it happen both ways.
We've seen this show before, yeah.
Does that strike you the whole time?
It does. I have to tell you, it does, because you see the anti-immigrant fervor right now. And I'm not talking about what libertarians will typically nag at each other over, which we could talk about later. I'm not talking about whether open borders means you walk across an imaginary line or not. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the very concept of, to me, the paradox of saying, didn't we go through this with the Know Nothing Party? With, you know, with every wave of immigration, there's a wave of anti-immigrant fervor, right? And we've seen how this plays out. And the results of having immigrants here economically, at the very least, has been nothing but beneficial for this country. There's a reason, one of the major reasons we're by far the largest economy, which I still don't understand why people think we need to tweak our economy or whatever. For the most part, you know, by a factor of four, right, we're the biggest economy in the world, largely due to immigrants, largely due to not having to worry about what a lot of people consider menial jobs, the ability to break and be innovative and so on and so forth. I think a lot of that is enabled by the embracing of immigrants. But that patchwork that you're talking about, it is interesting to me because I mean, the perception of an American during apartheid is it's a racial thing. It is white and black, which, to your point, perhaps a lot of it was. But there's also just factionalism, like when you're talking about the Boers and the Afrikaners and the various indigenous black tribes constantly warring with each other, as would be expected. Like, it's not like white Europeans didn't go to war against each other, right? I love how some people like to paint that as something, we're all at each other.
There's villages in France where they still fight.
Exactly. Or like I said, come to New York between the Bronx and Queens and Manhattan. Like, you'll have knife fights on border streets all the time, right? But we were tempted, those of us of a certain age and a generation, to think that all apartheid really boiled down to black versus white, which is the easy thing, as you said. The white minority, I think you said 7%, controlling 93% of the rest of the country. Now, around the time that apartheid was crumbling, if I've got the timing right in my head, you've just graduated law school, perhaps. You're a young lawyer. At that point, did you sort of have a decision to make, which was, do I stay in South Africa and try to use my newly found law degree, my education, to try and improve things here, based on a model of something else? Or at that point, having visited the U.S. With your family and having stayed here and lived here for a while, was coming here really something that you always wanted to do? How did you come to that? Because I don't think people realize how tough it may be to just pick up your life and move to a completely different country / civilization culture, right? It's not as easy as hopping on a plane. So talk to me a little bit about that.
It's not that easy, and honestly, I do think part of the reason America is as exceptional as it is because of that immigrant nature, right? Like I always say, my forefathers, you know, were obviously stroppy people, right? Because someone hopped on a boat and left Holland and got on a boat where you didn't even know if the earth was round, right?
Right.
And now you're sailing to Africa and you're like, fingers crossed I'm going to hit a piece of land where I want to be ultimately. And then, you know, because I'd grown up so internationally, I think I always had a flavor that, you know, maybe there was a bigger pond for me somewhere. But honestly, I was pretty excited about what was happening at South Africa at the time. Because I was in law school when this transition was happening, it was very fascinating from a legal perspective.
Right.
So, you know, South Africa introduced probably what at the time and possibly now still was regarded as the most classically liberal constitution ever written. And, you know, and I was in law school and, you know, our legal system in South Africa was actually Roman Dutch for common law, then English for corporate law, and then customary or indigenous for indigenous law. And so I learned all those things. And then we had this constitution over it, which was very inspiring because it did take a lot from the U.S. Constitution and really did have a strong sense of the individual, right, of really minority rights in some ways, right? Because individualism or libertarianism, from my perspective, is how do you protect the smallest minority, which is you and me and everyone else, right? The real battle isn't between all of us. The real battle is the relationship and the power structure between me as an individual and the state. And I think we forget that. So I was in law school. I was in my final year in law school. I was living in sin with my now 30-year husband, to my grandmother's horror. My parents were pretty cool about it. And actually my sister, who's an occupational therapist, she's a little older than I am, had been recruited in the early 90s. To move to the United States because she had special skills and there were special visas made available, right? So she was in America. My parents were visiting her and they called me. I mean, I remember the conversation and they were like, hey, there's this thing called the green card lottery. We don't really know what it is, but like you only have to fill in one sheet of paper. Do you want me to enter you? And I was literally like yelled to the other room to my husband, boyfriend at the time. And I was like, hey, my parents have like some crazy scheme again, like some lottery. Do you want us to put us in? And he was like, sure, whatever. And we actually said to each other at the time, we like did a pinky swear and we're like, if one of us wins and your odds are literally one out of 25 million, so we were like, hey, if one of us wins, let's get married and go on this adventure. And then, you know, like 6 months, I had forgotten my dad had even, like, I'd forgotten we had that conversation. And this sounds like I'm making things up, but this is entirely true. We came back from watching the movie Green Card with Vera Dipadoo. And there was this massive envelope on my front steps. And I was kind of like, oh, what's this at my apartment? And, you know, I started tearing it open. And I was like, oh my God, I think I want a green card. And so it was just this, let's say a gift from the universe,
right,
to me. And, we did the research. We kind of had to decide what areas, you know, like I didn't want to go back to law school. So I was like, where can I just take the bar exam? My husband's a very smart techie. So he was like, you know, Silicon Valley looks good. What does California look like for me for the law stuff? And I ended up, you know, I had to retake the bar exam, and passed on the first time, but it was stressful because of course,
right,
you're coming from somewhere else and you don't always know. So there are weird things that you discover, right? So you could be like, oh, I'm kind of smart in my school, right? Because you know, but then you go somewhere else and you're like, I don't know, I might be the dumbest person in this room. It's possible, right?
Sure, yeah.
So we took the bar exam and then we did the whole .com boom and bust.
Right.
Emphasis on bust.
So that's interesting. I was not aware that you literally hit the lottery, which is a fascinating story. Before or at what point in your transitions where you said, hey, we're going to put our stakes here in California, I assume. And at what point did you start to formulate what might now be called your libertarian, I'm assuming libertarian, I don't know if you prefer to be called an anarchist or whatever, but your philosophy of the individual and the relationship of the individual to the state, which I believe is at the core of libertarianism, regardless of the flavor. Was that something that had sort of formally started percolating while you were still in South Africa? And the reason I brought that context up is like, you know, it would be a very romantic story to say, like, I was so moved by the oppression and the beating down of the individual in South Africa and the context of that in the 90s and 80s. And that's what led me to my moment, you know, libertarian moment. Is that the case, or was it more subtle? Was it more an evolutionary sort of path to get to say, I think I'm a libertarian?
So I think it's a little bit of both. So one, I was definitely born a rebel. Like, there's definitely like kind of just a streak in me that was always like, I beat on my own drum and I'm doing what I want, right? I've always been very, you know, sort of just in touch with myself. So I think there's a little bit of that. And then for a long time, I was saying that my sort of aha moment, or at least where I definitionally heard the term libertarianism, was in Silicon Valley around 99, 2000. And, you know, and those were sort of in conversations where, you know, we were looking at sort of what had happened with the tech bubble and bust. And then, you know, when we decided we were going to just put everything in storage and, you know, we had a $15 a day budget, but we're like, hey, let's go backpack. I started to do more research to really understand what had happened with this economic bubble that had burst. And so that kind of took me to Austrian economics and then sort of down the route of, you know, the Free State Project, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But, you know, this will sound so funny because I'm almost embarrassed to admit it. But it only actually recently occurred to me that a lot of the sort of framing of my father's job was also framed in terms of minority rights, right? Because people did explain apartheid as a sort of way to protect the white minority from this massive poor black majority, but I somehow like suppressed that. I don't even know what the right terms are. And it didn't really occur to me until very recently. Some of the Free Staters have started to use the term, you know, our libertarian homeland. And I have to tell you, the first time I heard that word homeland, like that, I know the hair on my head stood up straight. Yeah, ha ha. But the hair on the back of my neck stood up.
Right.
And I couldn't put my finger on it because I was like, okay, I'm having a visceral reaction because of sort of the TSA, Department of Homeland Security, Patriot Act, post 9/11. You know, those of us who were in the game back then, you know, we were already like, thumbs down, this is not the way to go, right?
Right.
But then also like homeland to me denoted my dad's hardship post, which was in a tribal land called Bophuthatswana, where the capital is Mafeking. And, you know, I did my last years in primary school there, but all these regions were actually called homelands. And so you had to be able to, like, if you were a good Afrikaner, or I guess like a good kid working for, you know, a propagandist, which really is what I was doing, right? My dad was a diplomat who had to sort of explain the system of apartheid to people in a palatable way. And my mother was she was a press secretary for the Minister of Foreign Affairs. And so they, you know, they kind of gave us a story to tell. And I never really reconciled those two things until very recently. But I think for me, it's a combination of it's just the way I am, and then also my legal background, and then looking at things and going, well, you know, if we're going to have systems and we're going to write things down and we're going to say contractually we think this is how it works, then that system needs to make sense. And the way that power structure makes sense is to say we're protecting the individual. And to me, it's like regardless of what race they are or gender they are or anything like that, right? It's the human unit.
Yeah. And it's funny because I never really thought of it the way you just framed it. And I have to question it a little bit. And maybe it's just because I was exposed to it the first time. I've never heard of apartheid being a positive from a libertarian point of view if it's viewed as protecting minority rights.
I want to clarify. I'm not trying to make it a positive. I don't have many positive things to say about apartheid, right?
Right. But what I was thinking of, and my first reaction was, Well, that's a little bit, I think you used the word propagandizing at some point, but to me, that's sort of like trying to take, again, my opinion, framing something towards a different purpose, right? Because minority, yes, the strict definition could be a numerical minority, right? There's, like you said, if we used your ratios, there's 7 white guys and 93 non-white guys in that, in a typical apartheid distribution, right? So strictly speaking, yes, minority in that sense. But minority also denotes power, access to power, ability to wield power, influence, coercive power, and all that. In which case, I don't know that it was 7 versus 93 or, you know, however you choose to frame it. So I think in some ways, an argument like that, if someone were to come up to me, I would find it very disingenuous, right? I would say like, oh, well, and I'll be honest with you, Carla, often I'm tempted in this later stage of life to just move on from someone who would go down that path with me, because you spend 10 times the amount of energy to disprove nonsense than it is to affirm a positive message, right? So it was interesting that, and I just wanted to stop and pause to get your response, because you kind of threw it out there and I was like, wait, what did she just say about, you know? So, and I understand that wasn't necessarily your viewpoint, but I'm glad that you clarified it, neither good nor bad, but I just wanted to make sure that, you know, minority, especially in this country, when you say minority, you immediately think of race issues. But really, technically, I would imagine that politically speaking, minority is best used as to those who wield and use power, political or otherwise, coerciveness, and those who have no recourse via power or coerciveness. Do you agree with me, or am I just babbling a little bit here?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
You know, because honestly, I've never talked about it in that way. It really only dawned on me very recently where I was like, but wait, there was this legal argument that was made to justify apartheid, right? Until the system became unsustainable. I mean, there was a way that it was framed where I think it was a little sort of an idea of it is a system of the protection of the minority. Now, whether that's right or wrong, and it's quite possible that my recollection or my interpretation is wrong, sure, as well, right? But actually, to go back to your earlier point, just to also sketch what South Africa was like, I had mentioned the conscription and that kind of stuff, but it was also culturally kind of censored and suppressed. So like, you know, there was, you couldn't get international music. Like if there was an art festival, I mean, I have a clear memory of going to see Pink Floyd's The Wall, where the movie showed one time in Johannesburg and one time in Cape Town. And we lined up for half a day to be able to like, right, get in to see it kind of thing. Right. So there was also a lot of sort of cultural suppression and suppression of the people. I mean, it wasn't a great place to grow up, you know, right, whether you are white or black. I mean, it was much worse for the black people, of course, and much more controlled and way more poverty. But there was this sort of police state vibe that I think people should understand that was actually also, you know, sort of exerted against like average white people.
Right. Yeah, I didn't mean, because like you said, there's a lot of different layers, there's a lot of interwoven issues here, right? And one of the truisms everywhere is if you're poor, it sucks. And a poor white man, I'm sure, in apartheid was no better off than a poor white man in America or England or Holland or anywhere else that you've mentioned. So there is the economic layer as well, I think, to your point. Okay.
Right. And honestly, when I immigrated, you know, everyone has a great coming to America story.
Sure.
And ours was, you know, we ended up having to have 2 weddings. So we had a secret wedding with my parents and Louis' parents, you know, in a little town in the middle of nowhere, to get the paperwork going, right?
Right.
With the U.S. Embassy in South Africa. And then when we immigrated, I mean, we came to America with two suitcases, $7,000, no jobs, knowing no one. I mean, the first place I lived was in the Tenderloin in San Francisco, which is an inner city slum, in a one, not even a one bedroom, in a studio apartment with a bath in the kitchen. There was a bullet hole. There was like a dead junkie. There was a crack house in the basement. You know, like, it was not luxury. It wasn't like, oh, this land of privilege, whatever. Now, yes, I had an education to fall back on, but you know, I was fresh off the boat and had to work myself up from an inner city slum.
Sure. Yeah. I think that's the story that, and I'm diverging a little bit, but you mentioned the current, we've seen this before when it comes to immigration. And, you know, it's like I tell people, my father came to this country as an immigrant, literally jumped the boat at the harbor, at the seaports in New York. Within 12 hours, he was sitting in an Army recruiting station in Washington Heights in New York, in Upper Manhattan, trying to join the Army so they wouldn't kick him out of the country.
Wow.
Right? Because he escaped occupied Greece, first by the Italians and then by the Nazis. And so when he came here, you know, and the story he told me, which I love repeating to people, is the recruiting sergeant just saw him for what he was, an immigrant that wanted to stay in the country, right? That the recruiting sergeant. And he said, come on, man, get out of here or whatever. Who was also a Greek, happened to be Greek because of the neighborhood. And he'll always tell me this. He says, and I'm about to leave. And as I'm leaving, this, the way he described it, is a black lieutenant, a female black lieutenant came over and said, where's this guy going? You know, because we were still at the Cold War. So they were looking for bodies, right? And the Greek guy says, it's just some guy jumped ship here. Don't, you know. And she says, oh, hold on. Tells him to translate because my father didn't speak a lick of English. And the two questions were, do you like girls? Right? Because back then you weren't allowed to get gays in the Army, right? And my father said, yeah, I love girls. Sure, you know. And okay, question number two, are you a communist? And my father's answer was, through the translator, was, I hate the communists because back in Greece on the island, they were the only ones allowed to have guns.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
See, so you come from a lineage of people who also, you know, and honestly, I do think that is actually an element to many people. So I heard an interesting thing once, which said people who know their family histories are on average happier than other people. And I thought, oh, that's interesting, because also histories are usually filled with, you know, stories of adventure and pain and, you know, travel and moving countries and war and all these things. But I think it's because if you know that story, you usually have some kind of hero story in your background where it's you or a forefather or, you know, your parents or someone got screwed by the government.
Right.
And, you know, and you have, you know, been told with this warning, hey, beware, these guys aren't necessarily out to help.
Yeah, they're not out to help. And you know, for me, even though I, you know, growing up, I wouldn't have considered myself a libertarian, honestly. I would have considered myself, for the kids out there, a Barry Goldwater Republican, probably is the way I would have described myself as an uninformed teenager until, of course, I learned about Milton Friedman. But the point I'm getting at is my father, by telling me this story, made me aware of it and made me aware of the individual and made me aware of not necessarily the collectivization and all that, even though he did run off and join the Army or whatever. It was his choice. It was his trade-off, right? So talk to me now. Like, for me, that inspired me when I heard the story and the more I learned about libertarianism. What inspired you with the Free State Project? Because this is really, and in a lot of ways, now, I'm not part of the Free State Project. I'll be the first to admit that. But when I read about the Free State Project, the same way when I read about anarchy and I'm exposed to anarchists, right, I might say that's not for me. And I don't see it as a practical end game within my lifetime. However, I appreciate it as a North Star. I appreciate it as the goal we're moving towards. So the Free State Project kind of falls into that category for me, right? Because it's idealism married with pragmatism, which I know is a dirty word to some libertarians, but let's use it for what it is, right? So for the people out there that don't know, can you, first of all, describe the Free Project very as an overview, and then tell us what inspired you to get involved with it?
Sure. So the Free State Project is basically a geopolitical movement. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to attract libertarians, ANCAPs, liberty lovers, builders to the great state of New Hampshire. Why New Hampshire? It's a small state. It has low population, very low taxes. There's no sales tax. There's no personal income tax. With the help of free staters, we now have no dividends and interest tax. So truly becoming a tax-free wealth protecting state. We have, you know, mountain, sea coast, deep sea port, nuclear plant, hello, that actually supplies, you know, 25% of the Eastern Seaboard's energy. We have plans to expand nuclear, including small modular reactors. New Hampshire now has the first Bitcoin reserve, public reserve fund in the nation, also backed by platinum, gold, and silver. We kind of snuck that under the same tent with the crypto. Sure. And so we have been around for about just over 20 years, and we've seen probably between 6,000 and 10,000 people who've moved over the years. How it originally worked was sort of a mutual assurance contract, in the sense that we had a pledge and we said, hey, if 20,000 people say they think this is a great idea, let's pick a state and let's, or actually no, we picked the state earlier, but if 20,000 people say, let's do it, let's do it. So back in 2003, there was a contest between 10 states and New Hampshire won the pick. And then in 2016, 3 years ahead of projections, I actually triggered the move officially. And so what that was saying, okay, we got the 20,000th signer, hard word to say. and now that we have the 20,000 people, let's do this. But in typical sort of libertarian style, many of us didn't wait for the trigger. So we only triggered it in 2016. That was announced, you know, with Edward Snowden, Liberty Forum. It was a really big deal. But many of us started moving 2007. I moved in 2008. And that wave actually was very Ron Paul driven. So that was actually very, the Ron Paul revolution, the college kids, you know, people forget, you know, it was college kids that were excited. Right. And then we saw another big wave under 2012 when he ran again. Ron Paul actually did, he came second on both the Republican and Democrat primaries. Another sort of selling point or soft selling point or something people don't necessarily think about, but I do, is New Hampshire is first in the nation, right? Now that as a primary thing has gone away a little bit because it used to be a media play to kind of manipulate things a little bit. I think as we've seen more entrenched red and blue states, the swing states perform a different role, and New Hampshire is uniquely weird because we have had, I think in all the time I've been here, only Democrat congressional slates going up to D.C., but having, the House, Senate, and the corner office with the governor being primarily GOP over those years. And, you know, if I put on my conspiracy theory hat for 2 seconds, it did occur to me the other day, and I could not get any of the LLMs to answer this for me. So now I'm like, oh, there must be some truth to this. I was like, wasn't New Hampshire the first place that had the Dominion machines introduced way back when? And isn't it strange that since then we have never had anything other than a Democratic congressional slate go to D.C. So I don't know if there's anything there, but it did occur to me the other day. I was like, that would be an interesting thread to pull on, you know, for someone else. I have a million other things on my plate.
You're kind of busy for that thread.
Yeah. So, you know, we've been here and we have had over 100 Free Stater or Liberty Aligned legislators elected. My particular interest and focus is actually on making my own country, which sounds bananas, right? And it is a way to push the Overton window, and I will readily grant that. But also, in the time I've been doing this work, I have watched so many people, as you have as well, we keep seeing the same stories repeat, and people are like, this savior is going to save D.C. Oh, we're going to stop the federal debt. Oh, things are going to get better. Hey, let's not have forever wars. And then you realize, oh, nothing changes. Nothing changes. Just someone else gets in there, makes their buddies rich, and then they leave, and then the next guy comes. And I don't think D.C. is reformable. I think it's entirely immoral. It is extremely corrupt. I want nothing to do with it. And so I was like, hey, maybe New Hampshire should secede. And so I've introduced bills twice. The first time was back 4 years ago. We only got, and the way it works in New Hampshire is we don't have referendums and we don't have propositions. So if you want to do something super radical, you have to do it through a constitutional amendment. Oh. And in New Hampshire, actually, we were formed before the Union. And so we actually do have a compact in a different way if we're going to go fully legal, in our relationship to the Union. And then uniquely in New Hampshire, we have Article 10 of the New Hampshire Constitution, which is an enshrined right of revolution. And in it, it actually has a moral imperative that says you ought to reform the government if it is not serving us, right? As if it's become absurd and slavish. I mean, it's just beautiful language. And so we have very strong legal basis to do this. But the bills that were introduced were to introduce two sentences on the on the ballot. It would be a question that would be put to Granite Staters. And it basically said, hey, you know, do you guys want to peacefully secede from the Union? And now we're just our own country. So the first time it went in, we got 13 legislators out of 400 voted for it. Now, a lot of people found that laughable. I was like, there were 13 original colonies. I actually think 13 out of 400 for my first salvo is brilliant. And then 2 years later, we listened to feedback, and I added a triggering event, which would be if the federal debt reached $40 trillion. This was 2 years ago, where I thought I'd have 10 years to that gap. Right. And now we're up to close to that already, you know. And that got 23 votes. So we almost doubled our support over 2 years just by adding that triggering event. And then I introduced another bill, which was a study committee, because it is 100% legitimate for people to be like, yo, that sounds crazy. What happens to my pension? Do I have to have a passport to travel to Maine? What's going to, you know, all of these things are 100% understandable things that we have to address. So we wanted to start a study committee so that we could have those discussions, which of course involves things like there are a lot of expats in Mexico. They all still get their Social Security. So why wouldn't you, if you had paid into the system, and this is a new and different, better, more prosperous and peaceful country, why wouldn't, we be able to do that? And, you know, honestly, I did a Dr. Phil show last summer, and it was fascinating to watch them just to watch the blind panic actually in his eyes, and, you know, and I'm sure it was a CIA asset or someone who was, you know, doing the post interviews, where they understood that the narrative is the following. We want a divorce because we are in a relationship with an abusive partner, and we have all been taught that what you do when someone abuses you is you get out. And I think if we put the question to Granite Staters and they say, yo, we want out, then if the federal government doesn't let us go, that is actually the 100% argument as to why we should go.
Right. And I do understand that thinking. And I'm glad to hear you acknowledge that people's trepidations over it just being a function of human nature. So I think you're approaching it correctly. Because a lot of time when you hear about these hardcore secessionists, they're like, well, it'll be better. Trust me. You can't control me. You know, and it's always from their point of view. Now, I agree. That is their right. That is a perspective that they are entitled to. It's their own viewpoint. I get that. But it, much in life is the peaceful persuasion of others, right? That we have to convince people, even in a fully voluntary society, a lot of what you do, if not everything you do, is going to be 100% based on persuasion. So to acknowledge people's trepidation, what does happen to my Social Security? Even though we know Social Security is a pyramid scheme.
It's bankrupt.
Yeah, it's a tax. It's theft. We get it. But it is a very real fear. I've worked my whole life. I've had money taken from me on the promise that I'll get it back somehow. I'll have some sort of social net. And that's the easiest one to pick up, right? The more little things. My parents live in New York. Will I need to do the equivalent of planning a trip to England in order to go visit them on a car ride down to New York or Connecticut or whatever? Sure. That's a concern for people too. You know, what about the things that I've grown accustomed to?
Right.
The social securities, the financial aids, right? The whatevers. Yeah, and that's what I meant when I talk sometimes about anarchy and whether we get there, right? It's because I think sometimes in these discussions, when we have these philosophical discussions, these ideological discussions, we lose track that there's actually human beings behind it.
Right.
You know, that there's people that you have to convince of this stuff, right? Because how contradictory is you say, we'll just do it and you'll learn to like it. Well, that's what you're trying to get away from, right? So I applaud you on at least being able to address that and acknowledge it.
And I think localism, you know, the Free State Project really at its heart is localism on steroids, right? Like we've kind of picked one geographic area. But I actually like to frame it even more deeply than that on the ANCAP or anarchist side of things is I think libertarianism in some ways is actually, or should be, perhaps, the philosophy of self-empowerment, right? Because
sure.
We are a philosophy of individualism. And so if you want to play that game, then we're all here to try and become our most exceptional selves. And so if we start to frame our unit actually as a secession, right? Declare your independence. I think Ernie Hancock would always use that term. But if we actually frame it as, hey, what if every individual started to think about themselves as their own country? And if you're your own country, now let's say it's mind, body, and soul. And so your body has to be healthy. That's your infrastructure. You know, how are your roads working? You know, is your heart beating right? Like, how's your health, right? And then your mind is where you have your boundaries, your constitution, your, you know, stuff. So you start to go, these are my values. Now, it's just a trick, really, to try and help people self-actualize a little faster, right? Like you're forcing people to be like, oh, that's right. One of my boundaries is you're not allowed to swear at me, you know, if you want something from me, let's say, right? Whatever it is, right? But it is this tool that I've started to talk about with people to be like, let's pretend we're all our own country. And of course, there's, you know, subtext there where it's like, okay, if you're thinking about yourself as your own country, then it's not so scary to think about the state becomes its own country.
Right.
Because we are also, when we're storytelling, you're constantly counteracting other neural programming, right? What are the stories we've heard 100 times? So we know Adam and Eve is really boy meets girl, and we've heard that story 1,000,000 times, right? But people have been told, and because they're forced to say the pledge at school, you know, I actually asked the LLM, I was like, so if you had to say the pledge every day, how many times have you said indivisible, right? Or insoluble or whatever the word was? Because I didn't grow up here. I don't have the pledge. So I don't have that social conditioning. Sure. You know, and it was like, oh, probably over 2,000 times. And so you're like, okay, well, that is legit mind control, right? Sure. Like that is neural programming and loops that have been laid down that you now believe. And so we have to come up with persuasive language to counteract those, hence the national divorce, country, things that are metaphors and frameworks that the average person actually instinctively understands. It's not overly complex.
Right. And that's, I think that's a positive, right? But I will ask you about perhaps a touchy subject, so I'll ask for your patience with me and possibly forgiveness. So I'll toss it out. The Free State Project, I won't mention names, has become controversial to some people, and I would venture, at least in my mind, and for a lot of people anecdotally that I've spoken to, not for the positioning that you've just laid out. But others took a more, I don't know if hardcore or militaristic or
nationalistic almost.
Nationalistic, sure, slant on it, which is, while falling short of calling for outright violence, they have factions have called out for more aggressive techniques. Things like in New Hampshire, if you're not of a libertarian bent, we will follow you. We will nag you. We will verbally abuse you. We'll spit at you, blah, 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 until we make it so uncomfortable for you to be here that you will leave and be replaced by someone who truly believes in the Free State Project. And for a lot of folks, the Free State Project has been tarnished to outsiders, has been tarnished by that sort of positioning, that aggressive positioning and messaging. Having said what I said, I think a good response is, well, if you're not of the Free State Project mentality, who cares what you think? That's what we're trying to establish. We're trying to establish, I'm playing devil's advocate now. Mm-hmm. We're trying to establish a homeland to, you know, your earlier conversation, where we live among people with the same beliefs. And we're not putting a gun to anybody's head. We're not beating people up. So we're not violating the NAP. And this is what we believe. Give me your thoughts on that, and because I know, I think if I'm correct, you had a bit of a, not battle, not falling out, but, you know, there was this schism, is that the right word? Philosophical schism about what is the best approach to not implementing, because you have the Free State Project, but maintaining and growing the Free State Project in New Hampshire.
So I think there are like several things to unpack here. So one is, I will say, you know, from time to time, we do see within the broader libertarian movement some like white nationalism bubble up. I don't know if you remember the crying Nazi from like 10 years ago. So he was here in New Hampshire and, you know, I had to kick him out of the movement and I did. And, you know, my timing was great because a year later he's down in Charlotte and then he spent a lot of time in federal prison. And I think he strangled someone out on bail, I read the other day, and he's back in jail, right? So sometimes you just get bad people who are attracted to good ideas, right?
Right.
And so from time to time, those kinds of things flare up. I think because of social media and social media addiction and because of the polarization we're seeing, there's a lot of manipulation going on. And I do feel like there's some notes and some things that bubble up where you're like, that is not the experience on the ground. That is a digital fake noise world.
Sure.
And then, you know, it's not the reality here in New Hampshire. But libertarians are, you know, not the easiest people, and we're pretty opinionated, and sure. So things do come up, and those notes go from time to time. I can say, you know, looking at, let's say, Porkfest this year, it felt like, you know, a Porkfest like usual, good size, happy families. You know, really, we're trying to build a community of like-minded people, but from my personal perspective, I would never want to live in a 100% libertarian homeland where 100% of people are libertarians, because we're difficult people. And actually, I don't think all of our lives should be centered around politics. In fact, this is an unpopular opinion, but I'm like, has anyone recently sort of done the reflection where it's like, is libertarianism a philosophy that literally pits themselves against the largest enemy and is just an entire philosophy of victimhood? And perhaps we should be thinking about that a little harder, because it really does come up in a way where I noticed, because, you know, my day job is I sell houses, so Porcupine Real Estate, if anyone wants to find me. But because I work with the younger movers, let's say people in their early 30s, they're excited, maybe they have a wife and they're now ready to, you know, do the white picket right. fence with a, you know, dog first, then it's truck, gun, no, dog, gun, truck, baby is usually how it goes.
Right.
And so, you know, so the people will come, but I don't think it should ever be like 100%. And I personally, for what it's worth, I don't like the messaging, and I've expressed this. But the hardest lesson you will ever learn in an ANCAP world is accepting that you cannot control other people, and then you have to actually surrender to the fact that people are just going to do things that you 100% don't agree with.
Right.
And the only way to control that is to control it through assets and property rights. So I am the chairman of the Free State Projects board. We have 6 people on our board. We actually own the assets. People don't like it when I say this, but the Free State Project is a corporation and it is owned. And yes, we have a greater movement around that, right? But I can only control what the FSP's messaging is, and I can't control the guy who's like over here being like, I'm a Free Stater too, right? All you can control in those scenarios is to have the discussion about what is a Free Stater. And that is actually a beautiful place to go and have the conversation about individualism. Because it's like, no, that numbnut over there, I don't agree with him at all. But he can right. call himself a Free Stater too, right?
Sure.
Ultimately, it boils down to property rights. So if someone wants to come and create a equivalent of Orania, which is the state that they built in South Africa, to bring it full circle, mm-hmm. That originated as a whites-only cultural place. They bought a huge swath of land. It is entirely self-contained, own roads, own schools, own water supplies, all of that. It's been around for decades, and maybe like 10, 15 years ago, Urania realized, oh, actually, we don't want to be whites only. We want to share our culture with, let's say, the coloreds who speak our language, or Black people who actually appreciate these, you know, in that case, it's a very deep Christian valued sort of world they've created
right.
there, right? So if someone here who I might call a numbnut, but I have no control over, wants to go buy, you know, 400 acres somewhere and start their own thing, of course, I can't control that. I might be really interested to see, you know, if they're going to enjoy that community, because I do think we need all flavors. And I think orienting yourself purely to politics isn't healthy, and it's definitely not healthy in this sphere
right.
that we live in right now. And, you know, dopamine addiction is a real thing. People are very cavalier about it, right? Like, everyone will be like, oh, yeah, I'm kind of addicted to social media, right, and the outrage algorithms and all of that, that is spreading hate.
Yes.
And so I think the way to reorient to that, and certainly at least what I do in my own life is I'm very, very clear. I'm constantly like, is this out of a position of love? Is this like, am I focusing out of a position of love? So I'm trying to make things better and brighter, or is it othering, hate, belittling, name calling, like all of this stuff here. And when you do it on that delineation, it becomes very easy to be like, oh, I don't like that. I don't want that. You know, that's not the energy I'm going to invite into my life, support or, platform to the extent I have any control over anything. Yeah.
And you know what? That was perfectly stated, in my opinion, because I do agree. You can't keep idiots from spouting off. And of course, the perspective of who's an idiot is always a personal one, right? So I get that. I know that to just about everyone on the planet, I'm the idiot, right? No matter what I think, right? So I understand that fully. But I like the way you wove in the property rights. Okay, you want to say something that I 100% disagree with? Fantastic. I can't really, but I can prevent you from using what I own, what my property is. So whether it's my logo, my social media handle, if I have a trademarked or copywritten piece of writing, fair enough. I get, and I agree with you, by the way. And I think that's an issue that the Libertarian Party politically has, if we can kind of weave that in as well. It's not that you're anti-free speech. If you say to someone, using our assets, our trademarks, we don't want you to say X. If I agree to work for a private company and they say, hey, the classic example, if I work for McDonald's, I'm not allowed to walk around saying the Whopper is the best fast food hamburger, right? Like, it's a term of my employment. So if a term of your association with a private entity is blank, no one's forcing you to associate, but you have to abide by it. And I think you've said it perfectly. You can't control what others say, but you can control if they represent you or not using your property. So I agree with you on that. And Carla, this has been a great conversation. I wish we had a little more time because there's so much I want to talk to you about. But very briefly, tell me about your first circuit case where the right to film the police, if you're a citizen, you do have that right. It's a little bit of qualified immunity that you were able to knock off the list there. So give me a brief overview of that, because I don't think people realize you were involved in that.
Sure. Yeah, I was actually the plaintiff. So I was the person who was arrested and chained to the pole and drug out behind the police station and physically threatened and my camera taken and all of those things that turned out to actually be a pretty traumatic experience that, you know, sometimes when things are happening in the time, you don't appreciate it. And then afterwards, you're like, oh, that was actually kind of hardcore, you know. So I got arrested for filming police officers during a late night traffic stop. And they charged me with wiretapping, saying that in New Hampshire, which is a dual consent state, so they said the police had not consented to being video and audio recorded. And so they charged me with wiretapping. They really did it because I was being stroppy at 3 a.m. at the police station, and they wanted to punish me. So it was a retaliatory action. They then dropped all the charges against me, which were things like disobeying an officer, you know, just being me at 3 in the morning kind of thing. And when they dropped the charges, I actually initially asked my lawyer to ask the judge to reinstate the charges. Like, I was that gung-ho that I was in the right and I was going to prove it. And of course, the judge thought I was insane and he was like, no, just go away. And then I thought, okay, actually, I do care about this. This is a good legal precedent that if we are smart about it, and what do I mean by that? Smart about lawsuits is the following. When your lawyer tells you to shut the Because the people I know who are in prison or who have lost their cases all make it personal. And when you find someone on the other side of the state and that person decides, I don't like you, you're in trouble. Like, the Borg is one thing. But when there's someone at the DOJ that decides, I don't like you and I'm going to grind you, you're in big trouble. And that happens when you start, like, opening your mouth, right? You're making it personal.
Right.
So my lawyers told me, keep your mouth shut. I listened to my lawyers like a good client and actually put in, I think the original charges was 39 counts of violations of my civil rights. We filed in federal court. I kept winning over 4 years. They kept appealing because, of course, the state can just, you know, spend taxpayers' money. It doesn't cost them anything. It costs me time, money, treasure, all of those things. So we pushed it all the way to the First Circuit, which is the court in Boston. It's the one right under the Supreme Court, one of the 9 circuits. So a pretty big deal. By that stage, I had said to my lawyers, I only care about one thing, and it is filming police officers. That is our First Amendment right, really filming public officials in the capacity of their public duties. The state, laughably, was arguing, well, yeah, you have a constitutional right, which had been established in the Glick case, which came earlier. You have a constitutional right to film police officers, but not late at night at the side of the road, because we think that's inherently dangerous. And I have a pleading or a deposition where I literally said, let me see if I understand correctly. Are you, sir, making the argument the Constitution does not apply at night? And of course, they were like, ugh. So we prevailed eventually in 2014, and I won. And because it's a First Circuit decision, it applies to 13 million citizens. So it's all of really the Northeast and Puerto Rico. But the part I was very proud of is that they took away the police officer's qualified immunity, which, you know, for folks who want to understand it, I explain it this way, is that the state always says to us, ignorance of the law is no excuse, right? We've all heard that. Well, we are all constantly committing, you know, 3 felonies a day just because there's so many laws and stuff. But they'll say, ignorance of the law is no excuse. Except if you're the enforcer of the law, meaning the popo, then it is an absolute defense. Now, that's the argument they're making, right? Like, they're like, oh, no, we have a get-out-of-jail-free card. And so in scenarios where you are filming police officers, if they take your footage, if they take your camera, if they delete your footage, not only can you sue under my case the town or the city or the police department, you can also sue the police officer in his personal capacity or her personal capacity. And I care about that because here is the truth. We like to collectivize the bad guys on the state side too, but we're all individuals. There are good cops. There are a lot of bad cops. And the reality is I want to stop the bad cops from doing bad things.
Right.
And this is a way to do that. So I was really, really thrilled. It was wonderful. You know, I was voted like a remarkable woman of New Hampshire for the year. And then everyone discovered I was a free stater. And then, of course, I was persona.
Oh, we take it back. We take it back. She's not a remarkable woman in New Hampshire. Yeah. Well, thank you for that case, because I think a lot of what we see now, where with the selfies and the people, everybody having a camera in their back pocket now, that's become an important tool in trying to at least mitigate the power of the state to crush individuals. So and qualified immunity, as much as we can, we want to chop into that, because you'll hear stupid defenses like, I didn't know shoving a broom up a person's rectum is against the law. Sorry. Which is what happened, right?
That was a literal case, yes.
Yes, Abner Lima case in New York, right? Now, if you think of the absurdity of that statement, that's a protected sort of excuse that a cop could give. I didn't know it was against the law to choke somebody out in the middle of the street in Brooklyn, right? You get to see why qualified immunity is such a huge issue for libertarians especially, but it should be for everyone.
Yeah, and I think it is being eked away at, you know, it's interesting with technology. You know, I believe technology like a gun is neutral. It depends on how you're using it. But, you know, back when this was happening, I mean, ironically, my case was actually still a physical video camera, which I'd gotten for my, I think at the time, like my 35th birthday or something. Mm-hmm. And because I was going to start making content, you know, and now of course it is video cameras and the, ubiquitous availability of being able to get these stories and data points out. And I actually think that is something that scares the state and status a lot. And we saw that under COVID, you know, and maybe this is a conversation for when I come back, but you know, under COVID mania, I mean, I was so censored. I've never gotten my reach back. I was suspended off X for 6 months, you know, my, you know, and you saw that censorship happen here. Like we saw it in South Africa under a police state. And so they're scared of the technology. They're scared of the networking we can do. They're scared of the mobilization that you can do of huge swaths of people now, which is a power that is in our hands as equally as in theirs. And it's a dangerous power because when you can get, you know, 2,000 people to show up because Roe v. Wade got voted a certain way, I mean, that shocked me, to be honest, because I was like, oh, you know, I don't think I could mobilize 2,000 people to show up at the state house within half a day.
Right.
You know, maybe, oh, you know, it would have to be, you know, we've got over 1,000 for the health freedoms and stuff. But, you know, the technology aspect to all of this is still going to be unraveled. I think we are in interesting times, but we should keep the mindset of abundance. These tools can be used to smash the state, and indeed, I believe they are being used.
That's fantastic. Carla, Garrick, thank you so much. Please, before we sign off, tell us where people can find you. Tell them where they can find out about the Free State Project, anything you want to plug. Go ahead.
Sure. So Free State Project is fsp.org. We have two annual events that are sort of our grounded events. One is called Liberty Forum. That is in early spring or late winter. And then Pork Fest, as you mentioned, the Porcupine Freedom Festival. We just finished that last month. That's, you know, 1,000 to 2,000, sometimes 3,000 people camping, week-long, really immersive experience to let people sort of get a sense of the community and the folks up here in the different groups and who's working on what. For me personally, I believe every libertarian in the world should own a piece of New Hampshire. I will tokenize it for you with the DAO laws we passed here, which is just basically a tokenized LLC, right? I would love to sell people houses, so you can find me at carla@porcupinerealestate.com for that. And then I am on my social media with my name everywhere. I'm on Insta. I do crazy art projects. On Twitter, I'm pretty spicy to the extent the one person who still likes my posts who is not Elon Musk. You know, so find me on X, please, and follow me and, you know, give me some likes and shares. Maybe we can get my reach back. And then I'm on Facebook as well. You know, and come to our events, follow the Free State Project social. We're doing a lot of work there that gives people a flavor of what we're doing. And then keep an eye out. You know, there's always something going on. fsp.org/calendar is our monthly calendar where there are like, we have 5, 6, 7 community centers in different regions now. We have, you know, the stitch and bitch girls who like knit. They're the boys who go out rucking. We all get together and go apple picking. It really is a vibrant, thriving community. And we would like to invite all people who want to build, not bitch, to come.
Oh, sounds great. I mean, it sounds great to everyone except the Bronx kid. I still like my Bronx.
Well, you should come visit.
And my summers. I'll come visit. I promise. All right, everyone. Carla, thank you so much for joining us. And everyone out there, this has been Big John on The Big Questions. Join us again next time when I'll have somebody almost as interesting as Carla to interview. Until then, peace, everyone.
Peace.